A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking two things. First, why does crisis communications exist as its own specialized practice in PR, to the point where entire firms do nothing else? And second, what actually makes someone effective at it? Not just competent, but exemplary. It's a good question because most people hear crisis comms and picture someone sweating at a podium, but the specialty goes way deeper than that. So where do we even start?
I think you start with the obvious thing that most coverage misses. Crisis communications isn't just public relations with higher stakes. It's a fundamentally different animal. In regular PR, you're building reputation over time. You're planting seeds, nurturing relationships with journalists, shaping a narrative arc across months or years. In crisis comms, you're stopping a hemorrhage. The timeline compresses, the legal exposure is real, and every word you put out is potentially evidence in a lawsuit or a regulatory investigation. You can't workshop a crisis statement through 6 rounds of focus groups. The building is on fire, and you have to speak now.
It's PR with a lawyer looking over your shoulder and a stopwatch running.
And that's why firms specialize. You can't just take a brand strategist, someone whose entire toolkit is built around slow, cumulative reputation building, and drop them into a product recall where people are in the hospital. The muscle memory isn't there. The reflexes are wrong. I was reading through some industry analysis on this. There are firms like Sard Verbinnen, or Brunswick Group, or Citric & Company that built their entire practice around high-stakes crisis work. They don't do product launches. They don't do influencer campaigns. They don't pitch holiday gift guides to lifestyle editors. They exist for the moment when the CEO finds out at 2 a.m. that there's been an explosion at a plant.
Which raises the first part of the question. Why is this a distinct practice? You've got the time pressure and the legal entanglement.
Let me lay out the structural reasons. The Wikipedia article on crisis communication breaks this down well. There's a whole academic framework here that most generalist PR people never encounter. Timothy Coombs developed something called situational crisis communication theory, which categorizes crises into 3 clusters. You've got the victim cluster, where the organization is also a victim, natural disasters, workplace violence, product tampering. You've got the accidental cluster, where the organization caused the problem but without intent. Technical errors, equipment failures, and then you've got the preventable cluster, where the organization knowingly took risks or violated regulations. Each one demands a completely different response strategy. You cannot use the same playbook for all 3.
The taxonomy matters because the public's willingness to forgive depends on which bucket you're in.
And an exemplary crisis communicator knows this framework, cold. If you're in the victim cluster, you can express sympathy and ask for help. You can say, "This terrible thing happened to us too," and the public will grant you some grace. If you're in the preventable cluster and you try the same thing, you'll get torched. The public can smell when you're deflecting. They have an almost preternatural ability to detect when someone is using the victim posture to dodge accountability. Coombs actually mapped out specific response strategies, denial, diminishment, rebuilding, and matched them to crisis types. A generalist PR person might not even know this literature exists.
Which is your polite way of saying most PR people are out there improvising while the building's on fire.
I'm saying the academic foundation exists for a reason. But let me give you the concrete example that everyone in this field studies, the Tylenol crisis of 1982, Johnson & Johnson. 7 people died in Chicago from cyanide-laced Tylenol capsules. Someone had tampered with bottles on store shelves. This is the case study that basically invented modern crisis communications as a distinct discipline. Before Tylenol, the field didn't really have a canonical example of how to do it right. After Tylenol, it did.
This is the one where they pulled every bottle off every shelf, right?
31 million bottles. $100 million in product. And here's what made it exemplary. Johnson & Johnson had something called the Credo, written by Robert Wood Johnson in 1943. It explicitly stated that the company's first responsibility was to patients, doctors, and mothers, not to shareholders. It was a one-page document that had been hanging on office walls for decades, and a lot of employees probably thought of it as corporate wallpaper. But when the crisis hit, they didn't have to debate what to do. The framework was already there. The credo answered the question before anyone asked it. They recalled everything immediately, they cooperated fully with the FDA and the FBI, they set up a 1-800 hotline, they held press conferences daily. And they introduced the triple seal tamper-resistant packaging that became the industry standard.
The credo functioned as a pre-built decision matrix. When the moment came, there was no paralysis, no three-day debate about whether a recall would hurt the quarterly earnings.
That's the first thing that makes an exemplary crisis communicator. They're not starting from scratch in the chaos. They've done the scenario planning. They've wargamed the worst-case situations. The crisis plan already exists, and it's been tested. But there's a second layer here that's even more interesting. Johnson & Johnson's CEO at the time was James Burke, and Burke made a decision that was considered radical. He went on 60 Minutes. He went on national television and took questions directly. No prepared statement, no reading from a script, no carefully vetted talking points. He just answered.
That feels either brave or insane, depending on how prepared you are.
It was brave because he was prepared. And this gets to the core of what separates an exemplary crisis communicator from a merely competent one. Competence is having the statement ready. Excellence is having the credibility and the presence to deliver it in an uncontrolled environment. Burke understood something that a lot of executives miss. In a crisis, the messenger is the message. If you hide behind lawyers and written statements, you look guilty even if you're not. The medium of your response communicates as much as the content. A written statement says, "We lawyered this." A human being taking live questions says, "We're accountable."
The visual grammar of the thing matters as much as the words. A CEO who won't show their face is a CEO who looks like they have something to hide.
The research backs this up. There's a concept in crisis communication literature called stealing thunder. The idea is that if you disclose the bad news yourself, proactively, before journalists or regulators do, you retain more credibility and the story does less damage. The public perceives you as honest even though you're admitting fault. If you wait to be exposed, the same facts feel like a cover-up. An exemplary practitioner knows when to steal thunder and when to wait. It's not always obvious. Sometimes the legal team wants to hold back, and the comms person has to make the case that disclosure now is less damaging than exposure later.
How does that work in practice? The stealing thunder thing. Do you just call a reporter and say, "Hey, we have some bad news for you"?
It's more structured than that. You might pre-brief a trusted journalist with the full story on the condition that they hold until you've made your own public statement. That way, when the story breaks, the first version includes your framing and your acknowledgement of responsibility. The alternative, waiting for an investigative reporter to unearth it, means the first version of the story is, "Company hid this." And once that frame is set, it's almost impossible to dislodge. The psychological research is really clear on this. People anchor on the first version they hear.
What's the counter case? The one where they got it wrong?
Oh, there are so many. But the canonical example is BP after the Deepwater Horizon explosion in 2010. 11 workers killed, the largest marine oil spill in history. And BP's CEO at the time, Tony Hayward, gave a series of statements that became textbook examples of what not to do. He said, "I'd like my life back," while people in the Gulf were losing their livelihoods. He downplayed the environmental impact, claiming the Gulf was a very big ocean that could absorb the spill. The company's initial response was slow, defensive, and tone-deaf. They tried to minimize rather than confront.
"I'd like my life back." That's a four-word masterclass in how to torch your own credibility. It's almost hard to believe a human being said that out loud.
It illustrates something crucial about crisis comms as a specialty. In regular PR, you can recover from a bad quote. You put out a clarification, you move on. Maybe it gets a day of mockery and then it fades. In a crisis, every sentence is indelible. The news cycle doesn't give you a do-over, which is why the specialized firms exist. They know that the first 48 hours determine the entire trajectory. Get it wrong in the first 2 days, and you're spending the next 2 years doing reputational triage, and you may never fully recover. BP is still associated with that spill, and with Hayward's quotes, more than a decade later.
This specialization exists because the error tolerance is effectively zero. You mentioned the legal entanglement earlier. How much of this is just lawyering with better posture?
It's a real tension. In a lot of organizations, the general counsel and the communications lead are in direct conflict during a crisis. The lawyer wants to say nothing because anything you say can be used against you in litigation. The communicator wants to say something because silence looks like guilt in the court of public opinion. And both of them are right, from their respective frameworks. An exemplary crisis communicator knows how to navigate that tension. They can draft a statement that expresses concern and takes responsibility without creating legal liability. That's a specialized skill that takes years to develop. You have to understand what language triggers what legal exposure, and you have to find the narrow path between admission of liability and sounding like a soulless automaton.
You're essentially bilingual. You speak lawyer and you speak human, and you translate between them in real time.
That's a beautiful way to put it, and the best practitioners do it under conditions that would break most people. I was reading about Michael Citrick. He founded Citrick & Company, one of the first boutique crisis communications firms. He's handled some of the most high-profile crises of the past few decades, and his philosophy is basically that you have to control the narrative, or someone else will. He's famous for what they call the Citrick response, a rapid, comprehensive counter-narrative that doesn't just deny bad facts, but reframes the entire story.
Control the narrative has become a cliché, but I assume in his framework it means something more specific.
For Citrick, it means you don't just respond to the questions you're asked. You answer the question that should have been asked. You provide context that changes how the facts are understood. If a company is accused of something, and the accusation is technically true but misleading, you don't just say, that's misleading. You explain what's actually happening and why the surface-level reading is wrong. And you do it fast, because in the information vacuum, the accusation becomes the truth. Here's a concrete example. Suppose a company is accused of laying off 500 employees. The headline writes itself. But what if those 500 employees were temporary workers hired for a specific project that ended and the company actually added 200 permanent positions in the same period? That context changes the story entirely. The Citrick approach is to get that context out immediately, not 3 days later when everyone has already formed their opinion.
Which brings up speed again. How fast is fast enough?
The old rule was the golden hour. You had 60 minutes to respond. That's basically obsolete now. With social media, the window is more like 15 minutes, sometimes less. I saw a piece from the Institute for Public Relations that found that 53% of crises spread internationally within an hour. If you're still drafting a statement at the 90-minute mark, you've already lost the narrative. The story has a shape, it has a villain, it has a hashtag, and you're not even in it yet except as the target.
The specialization exists partly because the clock speed of the internet is incompatible with generalist workflows. A regular PR firm has approval chains and multiple rounds of review. A crisis firm has a pre-authorized rapid response protocol.
And this is why you see firms that do nothing but crisis work. They maintain war rooms that are always ready. They have pre-drafted holding statements for dozens of scenarios. They've mapped out the stakeholder landscape for their clients before anything goes wrong. They know which reporters cover which beats, which regulators have jurisdiction, which activist groups will mobilize. All of that reconnaissance work happens during peacetime so that when the crisis hits, they're not scrambling. They're not Googling which FTC division handles this. They already know.
It's the communications equivalent of a fire department. You don't call them when your house is already burning to ask if they can maybe read up on fire suppression techniques.
Like a fire department, they run drills. Tabletop exercises where the executive team has to respond to a simulated crisis in real time. A fake news story breaks, the phones start ringing, and they have to make decisions under pressure. The best firms run these regularly, and they're brutal about the after-action reviews. What did we miss? Where did we hesitate? I've heard of exercises where they simulate a hostile press conference with actors playing aggressive reporters, and the CEO has to stand there and take it. Half the time, the CEO discovers they're not as ready as they thought.
Let me pull on the second part of the prompt more directly. The exemplary practitioner. You've touched on preparation, speed, legal fluency, presence. What's the thing that separates the top percentile from the merely good?
I've thought about this a lot. I think there are three qualities that don't show up in the textbooks but matter enormously. The first is judgment under uncertainty. In a crisis, you never have complete information. You're making decisions based on fragments. A preliminary report, an eyewitness account that might be wrong, a social media post that might be fabricated. An exemplary practitioner has the nerve to act on incomplete data and the humility to revise when new facts emerge. That combination, decisiveness and intellectual humility, is genuinely rare. Most people have one or the other. They're either decisive and stubborn or humble and paralyzed.
That's a really interesting tension. How do you train for that?
You can't really train for it in a classroom. You develop it through experience, through being in situations where you had to make the call and then live with the consequences. But you can accelerate it by studying past crises and asking yourself at each decision point, what would I have done here and why? The second quality is what I'd call moral clarity. Not in a grandiose sense, but the ability to quickly identify what the right thing to do is and then to argue for it internally even when it's expensive or embarrassing. A lot of crisis communications failures aren't communications failures at all. They're failures of institutional courage, where the comms person knew what to say, but the leadership wouldn't say it.
The comms person becomes the conscience of the organization in that moment.
That's a lonely position. You're in a room with the CEO, the CFO, the general counsel, and you're the one saying, "We have to admit this was our fault." Everyone else is looking at the liability exposure, the stock price, the quarterly earnings, and you're saying none of that matters if we lose the public's trust permanently. The exemplary practitioner wins that argument often enough to be effective and knows when to escalate if they're not being heard. The third is harder to define. I'd call it tonal precision. In a crisis, the register you speak in matters as much as the content. Too formal and you sound like a robot. Too casual and you sound flippant. Too emotional and you sound unstable. The exemplary practitioner finds the exact right emotional frequency for the specific crisis. Somber but not defeated. Concerned but not panicked. Apologetic but not groveling. And they maintain it across every channel, every interview, every statement. If you watch the James Burke 60 Minutes interview, his tone is remarkable. He's not performing gravity. He's not doing a serious CEO voice. He sounds like a person who is affected by what happened, and that genuineness is what makes it land.
That's the thing you can't fake, isn't it? You either have the ear for it or you don't.
I think you can develop it, but not quickly. It comes from watching a lot of crises unfold and studying which responses landed and which didn't. It's pattern recognition more than technique. You watch the BP response and you feel in your gut that it's wrong before you can articulate why. Then you analyze it and realize he made it about himself. I'd like my life back. The crisis was about the 11 workers who died and the communities whose coastlines were being destroyed, and he made it about his inconvenience. Tonal precision means never, ever making the crisis about you unless you're the victim.
Let's talk about the dark side of this for a second. Crisis communications as a discipline exists in part because organizations do bad things and need to manage the fallout. Where's the line between legitimate crisis response and reputation laundering?
That's the ethical boundary that defines the field, and honest practitioners think about it constantly. The line is whether you're telling the truth. If you're helping an organization communicate honestly about a genuine accident or a problem they're actually fixing, that's legitimate. If you're constructing a narrative to obscure wrongdoing or deflect accountability, you've crossed into something else. And the exemplary practitioners I've read about and spoken with are very clear about this. Their credibility is their only asset, and they won't destroy it for a client. They'll resign an account before they'll lie on behalf of one.
Because if you get caught lying once, you're useless for every future client.
Your entire value proposition is that when you stand at a podium and say something, people believe it. The moment you're known as someone who helped cover up a scandal, that's gone forever. And in a world where everything eventually comes out, where whistleblowers have secure channels and journalists have long memories, the lie is a time bomb. The good firms fire clients who won't take their advice. They'll walk away from a contract rather than be associated with a dishonest response. There are documented cases of crisis firms returning retainers because the client insisted on a strategy that was deceptive.
There's something almost paradoxical there. The specialization exists because organizations need to protect their reputation, but the best practitioners protect their own reputation by being willing to walk away from organizations that need protecting from themselves.
That's the paradox at the center of the whole discipline. and it connects back to why it's a distinct practice with its own norms and standards. General PR doesn't have the same life-or-death stakes for the practitioner's own credibility. If a product launch flops, the PR firm just moves on to the next campaign. If a crisis response is exposed as a lie, the crisis firm is finished. Their name is attached to the scandal forever. So the incentives are actually aligned toward honesty, at least for the firms that plan to still exist in a decade.
The specialization is partly self-policing. The stakes are high enough that the market weeds out the bad actors faster.
In practice, there are plenty of firms that operate in the gray zone. But the ones with lasting reputations, the Brunswick Groups, the Sard Verbinnens, they've survived decades because they're selective about clients and rigorous about ethics. They know that one bad client can undo 20 years of reputation.
Let me ask you something from the medical angle. Since you spent years in practice, you dealt with situations where you had to deliver terrible news to families. Is there overlap with crisis communications?
Delivering a difficult diagnosis to a family is a form of crisis communication. You're operating with incomplete information, the emotional stakes are enormous, and how you say it matters as much as what you say. The main difference is scale. In a hospital room, you're communicating with 5 people. In a corporate crisis, you're communicating with 5 million. But the core skill is the same, honesty delivered with compassion, and no false reassurance. You don't tell a family everything's going to be fine if you don't know that. You tell them, here's what we're dealing with, here's what we're going to try, and I'll be honest with you every step of the way.
You mentioned no false reassurance. That feels like a principle that applies across both domains.
It's the hardest thing to get right because the human impulse is to make people feel better. You want to offer comfort. But in a crisis, saying everything's going to be fine when you don't know that it will be is a betrayal of trust. The exemplary communicator says, here's what we know, here's what we don't know, and here's what we're doing to find out. That's it. No promises you can't keep. Because if you promise something and it doesn't materialize, you've compounded the original crisis with a second crisis of broken trust.
Which loops back to your point about judgment under uncertainty. You're comfortable saying, I don't know, in a context where everyone wants you to have answers.
That comfort is rare. Most executives, most spokespeople, feel a compulsion to fill the silence with certainty. They think leadership means having all the answers. But the public is more sophisticated than they're given credit for. People can handle uncertainty if you're honest about it. What they can't handle is being lied to. There's actually research on this. People rate spokespeople as more credible when they acknowledge uncertainty appropriately than when they project false confidence. The audience can tell the difference.
If we were going to synthesize this, why crisis comms is its own specialty? It comes down to time compression, legal entanglement, zero error tolerance, and the fact that the core skill set is distinct from brand PR. And the exemplary practitioner has preparation, speed, legal fluency, moral clarity, tonal precision, and the willingness to say, I don't know.
One more thing I want to add, because it doesn't get said enough. The exemplary practitioner understands that a crisis is not just a communications problem, it's an operational problem that has communications dimensions. The best crisis response in the world won't save you if you haven't actually fixed the underlying problem. Johnson & Johnson didn't just communicate well, they actually pulled the product, actually redesigned the packaging, actually made it safer. The communications were built on operational reality. If they had just issued beautiful statements and left the bottles on the shelves, the statements would have been worthless.
That's the distinction between managing the narrative and managing the crisis. The narrative follows the facts eventually. You can shape it, you can frame it, but you can't invent it out of whole cloth.
The firms that understand this are the ones that last. They don't just advise on what to say, they advise on what to do. Sometimes the best crisis communication strategy is fix the problem first, then talk about it. That might mean shutting down a production line, firing a senior executive, or redesigning a safety protocol before you hold the press conference. The communications should reflect action, not substitute for it.
Which is a hard sell to a CEO who wants the bad headlines to stop immediately.
It's the hardest conversation in the business. I can't make this go away with a press release. You have to actually change something. And the exemplary practitioner has the backbone to say that to someone who's paying them a lot of money. They're willing to be fired for telling the truth, and sometimes they are fired. But the ones who last are the ones who have that conversation and win it.
Let me pull on one more thread before we wrap the main discussion. You mentioned social media compressing the response window to basically nothing. How has that changed the nature of the specialization over the past decade?
It's changed everything. In the pre-social era, you had hours to coordinate a response. You could get the legal team on a conference call, draft a statement, circulate it for approvals, and still be ahead of the evening news. Now the crisis breaks on Twitter or TikTok or wherever, and by the time you've assembled the conference call, there are already 10,000 hot takes and 3 trending hashtags. The specialization has had to evolve from rapid response to instant response, and that changes the entire operational model. You can't have a committee approving every tweet. You need pre-authorized communication protocols and people empowered to execute them.
Which means the preparation has to be even more front-loaded.
It means the holding statements have to be pre-written and pre-approved. It means the dark posts and the response templates are ready to go before anything happens. It means you've already identified the influencers and reporters who will shape the coverage, and you have relationships with them. And it means the crisis war room includes social listening tools that track sentiment in real time, so you can see how your response is landing and adjust within minutes. If a statement is being read as defensive when you meant it to be empathetic, you need to know that immediately and pivot.
There's something slightly dystopian about sentiment, tracking a tragedy in real time.
It feels clinical in a way that can be uncomfortable, but it's also useful. If you put out a statement that's meant to express concern and the sentiment analysis shows that people are reading it as defensive, you need to know that immediately. You can't wait for the morning papers. You can't wait for the focus group next week. You have to course correct in the same news cycle, or the defensive reading becomes the permanent one. I do, actually. I'm old enough to remember when a crisis unfolded over days, not minutes, when you had a full news cycle to prepare, when the worst thing that could happen was a bad segment on the evening news, not a global trending topic.
You're old enough to remember when a crisis was delivered by carrier pigeon.
That's unfair. It was the Pony Express, and we were grateful for the lead time.
To bring this back around, the prompt asked why this is its own well-defined practice and what makes someone exemplary at it. I think we've covered the structural reasons. The practice exists because the cost of failure is catastrophic, the skills are non-transferable from general PR, and the time pressure has accelerated to the point where only dedicated specialists can keep up. And the exemplary practitioner combines preparation, speed, judgment, moral clarity, tonal precision, and the willingness to advise on operations, not just messaging.
I'd add, they're students of the craft. They've studied the Tylenol case and the BP case and every case in between. They know the academic literature. They know the legal frameworks. They know the psychological research on how people process information under stress. It's not just instinct. It's a body of knowledge that you have to master. The exemplary practitioner can tell you why Coombs put a particular crisis in the preventable cluster and not the accidental one. They can cite the research on stealing thunder. They've read the postmortems. They're not just talented, they're educated.
The walking encyclopedia approves of the body of knowledge.
I contain multitudes.
You contain a lot of index cards, is what you contain. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1980s, the Kingdom of Bhutan commissioned a study of traditional Buddhist Thangka painting pigments and discovered that a particular shade of deep orange used in wrathful deity depictions was achieved by mixing vermilion with a trace amount of arsenic sulfide, a recipe that had been passed down orally among monastic painting guilds for at least 400 years without ever being written down. The pigment was prized for its luminous quality that didn't fade, and the artisans who worked with it developed a specific technique of applying it in thin glazes to minimize direct skin contact.
The monks were working with arsenic paint for centuries, and apparently no one thought to mention it. 400 years of oral tradition, and nobody said, "By the way, this one's poison."
Probably contributed to the wrathfulness. You spend 4 centuries inhaling arsenic dust, you're going to paint some angry deities.
I wonder if the oral tradition included safety instructions that just got lost, or if the safety instructions were part of it, and the monks just accepted the risk as part of the spiritual practice.
That's actually a fascinating question. In a lot of traditional craft guilds, the hazardous materials knowledge was part of the initiation. You were taught how to handle them safely as part of the sacred knowledge. It's possible the Bhutanese painters had a whole set of protocols that the Western researchers didn't document because they were focused on the pigment composition, not the handling practices.
Step 1. Mix the arsenic. Step 2. Don't lick the brush. Some things transcend culture. So where does this leave us? I think the open question is whether crisis communications as a specialization survives the next decade in its current form. The tools are changing. AI-generated statements, deepfake risks, synthetic media crises that aren't even real. A bad actor could generate a fake video of a CEO saying something terrible, release it at midnight, and watch the stock tank before anyone can verify it's a forgery. The discipline is going to have to evolve again, and probably faster than anyone expects.
That's the thing about crisis communications. The crisis itself is always changing. The next Tylenol moment won't look like Tylenol. It might not even involve a physical product. It might be an AI hallucination that goes viral and tanks a stock before anyone can verify it, or a deep fake of a CEO confessing to something that never happened. The practitioners who thrive will be the ones who can adapt their frameworks to threats that don't exist yet. The core principles, honesty, speed, tonal precision, moral clarity, those will still apply. But the tactics will have to evolve dramatically.
Same as it ever was, just faster and weirder.
Which is basically the tagline for the 21st century. Every discipline is becoming crisis communications in a way. Everyone is operating with less time, less certainty, and higher stakes than they were a decade ago.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for the fact, and for keeping this operation running. This has been My Weird Prompts. You can find every episode at My Weird Prompts. If you enjoyed this one, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep, the stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close, from sloth, from man, from long ear. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.